The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder why some people find it easier to put their faith in God than others. That's a great question, my friend. And to explore it with me, we are honored to have on our show for the second time, he was on a couple of years ago, Mike Sicaro, host of KCBQ's Saturday Night Sock Hop. It is a great show. He does a great job. We're honored to have him on our show today. Mike, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Bob. Good to be in the hot seat.
Yeah.
I don't recognize my own voice without the reverb. You need reverb on this show, Bob, believe me.
Oh, really? And I understand that the football season, at least as far as radio goes, is winding down, so maybe your show won't get preempted so darn much.
That's it. I think we're absolutely finished with the football games, and nobody could be happier about it than me.
Well, you know, football's the great American pastime, but for those who aren't into football, that must be frustrating. I guess those that are into football, that's what could be better than football? That's life as they know it.
We were just saying, give each team their own ball. They wouldn't have to fight over it. Save them. Nobody listens. That's my. When I'm king, it's going to be different. Don't
there
worry.
We go. Well, these days I'll take anybody as king other than what we got, so you'd probably get my vote. Well, listen, we talked a while ago, and sounded like you had some questions about some things regarding religion, but let's just start. Tell us a little bit about your own religious background. I believe you mentioned to me that you grew up with a Catholic upbringing and didn't quite take, which is a very common story, not just from Catholics. We're not picking on any of them. That's very common with a lot of different kinds of churches. But tell us a little bit about your background. What didn't take? Why didn't it take?
I don't know. You know, I went through the whole routine from grade school through high school. I went to Catholic school except for second and third grade. And all my friends that I went to school with, I would say that they have anything from a strong faith to at least, you know, a moderately strong faith. And I don't, for some reason, it never really connected with me. And I went through the same things they did. My parents took me to church. They were not hardcore Bible thumpers, so to speak. The teachers I had in school didn't really lean on me. So there was no singular bad experience that I had. I just never really, so far, as of tonight, have developed that faith that many people seem to have.
And that's interesting, because a lot of people will say, well, when I was a child, I had faith, but it didn't stay with me. But you're claiming that even as a kid, you never had anything. Would you have said as a kid that you believe in God, or would you have questioned your parents even then and said, how do I know God exists?
I would say once I reached the age of reason, maybe, I don't know, 10, 12, 13 years old, I had serious doubts. I would not call myself an atheist, but I would say I'm just not sure.
Well,
I'm
not sure if you realize it, but we actually call our radio show a sanctuary for skeptics and doubters. We don't believe that doubt is a four-letter word here. I think when people have doubts, it keeps them from being brainwashed. It keeps them from following Pied Pipers and deception. So the fact that you had doubts, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, because it shows that you're a critical thinker. So I wanted to start with that premise. I'm not assuming that that's a bad thing, that you have questions and doubts.
Okay. I'm not talking about doubts about the dogma of the church. I'm talking about doubts of faith in general, just so we're on the same page. I mean, I don't want to veer off into theology, which is an episteme, and you got me beat on that. And I don't want to veer off into the dogma of any organized religion, because why do some people have faith and some people don't? And why was I raised and why did I grow up around it? And it just didn't really connect so far. Could happen tomorrow, but
well,
so far has
let's
not.
Let's begin with I think we want to define some terms. How would you define faith, Mike?
Belief in God. I think that would probably be
okay.
The primary point.
Some people would call belief in God, a faith without any evidence for God. Would you include that in your definition, or would you say that even one who sees evidence for God is exhibiting some kind of faith?
I would say if you have faith, you don't need proof. To me, I think that's what it's always been put across to me. You know, don't question it. God's up there. Have faith.
Yeah.
You don't have faith. Well, you know, sorry, can't talk to you anymore. That's...
Well, now this might be an interesting discussion because as you're defining faith, and I think a lot of people do define faith exactly that way, I do not believe that that kind of faith is a good thing. I would not want to see a person follow God or anything without question. And neither would I make the claim that I have that kind of faith when I know you wanted to stay off the Bible, but it's a little bit unavoidable. The writers of the New Testament, when they used the word faith, they didn't mean that they were blindly following something. They were assuming that one could actually meet and encounter and have an experience with God. And when they used the word faith, they meant, do you have the faith to trust God to work in your life? It would be like the faith kids have in their parents. If parents say, look, this curfew is for your own good, you're going to have to trust us. Okay, it takes faith to believe that mom and dad are correct.
Mm-hmm.
But the kid's not going to bed saying, gee, I wonder if mom and dad even exist. You see the difference? So that's a qualitative difference in the way one looks at the word faith. The Bible did not define faith the way many people define faith today.
So you're using faith as a metaphor for trust here? Is that what you're saying, more or less?
That's the way the writers of the Bible used it. And in my case, I was raised as a Jewish atheist. I wasn't even raised in the church. And I had an actual mystical encounter with God. And during my second year of college, I was a thinker. I was a skeptic. I was a doubter. It took nothing less than God just literally coming and clunking me on the head.
You had a transformative experience.
Yes, okay. Which is not the same as faith. Because if we've experienced something, then we can test that experience. We can ask questions about it. We can say, okay, why do I believe this experience is real? There's a lot of things that go with that.
All right. I'm 54. I have yet to have a transformative experience. I'm not trying to make light of it. I'm just telling you, many people who have an unshakable faith as you do have had some type of pivotal event in their life, an experience as you've had, and just turned the switch. Wow, I was wrong, and how did I not see the light, and boom, here I am.
Right, right. And then there are others who did not have a pivotal experience, but they just, as you defined faith, they'll say, well, I grew up in the church, and I've just always believed this. And there, so many people are dealing with it from that point of view also. But I do believe that if there is a God, it would make sense that he would strive to make himself known. One of the things I hear all the time is people say, well, I don't have any trouble believing in a God, but a God who speaks, a God who talks, a God who would have given visions to the men who wrote the Bible. They said, I have trouble with that kind of God. And I'm saying, well, why is that? If you can talk as a human being, you're able to talk, I'm able to talk. Certainly we can't do something that God can't do. So if we can speak and communicate, then obviously God can speak and communicate. Well, then the next question is, well, then why wouldn't he speak and communicate? He obviously created us for some purpose. If he created us, we're here for some reason. And he's going to say, well, I know what that reason is, but I'm not going to tell you. I'm just going to sit up here. I'm just going to mess with your head. That would sound like a vindictive God. That wouldn't sound like a loving God. So I would assume that if God can speak, he would speak. So then the next question is, if he's been speaking to human beings since the beginning of history, and it would have to be since the beginning of history, otherwise he'd be showing partiality. If he just started speaking in the 21st century, that would be unfair to everybody who lived before. You'd think it would have left some kind of record and imprint upon history. And so then the next question would be, well, was there? Do we have a collection of ancient documents that look like this imprint of the God of the universe intersecting with history? So that's where I would go with it. And as you can see, that's very different than one who says, well, I just believe this by faith.
Okay, this transcends the Bible.
Sure.
This goes into the Quran and the Torah and every other written work, every document of religion. So it's not just the Bible per se. I mean, we're talking about any written record of religion, no matter what text you may use.
That is absolutely true. Any written text which claims to have record of divine activity. Now, simply because they all make that claim, that doesn't mean that what they're saying is true. When we start looking at the Bible and the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita of the Hindus, we notice that what they're claiming completely contradicts other claims. Now, years ago, the Greek philosopher Aristotle, came up with a rule that's pretty foundational to any philosophy class. And I think anybody, Christian or atheist or agnostic, would agree with this. It's called the law of non-contradiction. It says if you have two truth claims and they contradict themselves, they can't both be true. They could possibly both be false. But if they contradict themselves, at the most, only one of them could be true. So if a man calls his wife on the phone and says, "Sweetie, I'm coming home for dinner, but also I'm not coming home for dinner," I don't think that would sound like a very good statement to his wife. She'd say, "Look, you're coming home or you aren't." And we, see, we accept this all the time with other things in life. Somehow when religion enters the conversation, I think even though people don't state it in so many words, when religion enters the conversation, it's almost assumed that we're talking about something that can't be verified, that isn't really true, or at least there's no possible way to know whether it's true, as if we're talking about comforting man-made fantasies. And that's why when religions get into arguments about who's the correct religion, it sounds ridiculous to an observer on the outside, because it sounds like they're arguing over the Lord of the Rings versus the Chronicles of Narnia or Harry Potter. They'd say, they're all fantasies. What difference does it make? Just pick the one you want. But what's interesting is the founders of these religions, like Muhammad, like Jesus, they weren't claiming to have made up comforting fantasies. They were claiming to have revelation from God. That's a serious truth claim. And I think that, along with any truth claim, whether it's a scientific claim, historical claim, political claim, I think they all need to be tested and scrutinized. So I would say you're right on square one. The fact that the Bible claims to have revelation from God, that in and of itself means nothing, because the Quran and other holy books will make the same claim. But the fact that they contradict themselves says, okay, they can't all be true. Maybe they're all false. Maybe they're all out to lunch. But if any of them are true, only one of them are true, because you can't have 10 different people saying we're the only way to God completely contradicting themselves.
No, so you're looking for criteria that are both necessary and sufficient.
Yes.
Okay.
Very
now
well.
Let's stay along those lines.
Okay. Okay.
And remember, I hope, but which you could explain to me if you can, ultimately, what is the quintessence of faith? What does it really come down to? What is the difference? Why do some people have it and some people don't, in varying degrees?
Okay. So
but we'll talk. We'll
discuss that.
We've still got 45 minutes. I expect big answers from
big
you,
Bob. Answers.
All right.
Yeah, I've been here for several years on the radio. Yeah. I better come up with a big answer,
don't
too.
Make me start playing music.
Okay. Right. My special guest, Mike Sicaro of Saturday Night Sock Hop. We're really pleased to have him. We will be right back.
Bob now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
More beautiful.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric.
Welcome back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. I will not be with you the next few weeks. I'm going to be taking some time off around the Christmas holiday. But even though I won't be in the studio live, the Bob Siegel Show will still air. Next week will be a repeat broadcast. of a show that I did for the first time just around the same time of the year last year when I reviewed the best and the worst of the holiday movies. The following week, we repeat one of our classic programs that we've played many times. I had the privilege of interviewing Sylvia Lane, niece of Hugh Martin, who wrote the celebrated Christmas song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And after Mr. Martin became a Christian himself, he changed the lyrics on our program. We got to hear his niece sing the new version of that song. So a couple of repeat shows these next couple of weeks, and then I'll be back. I always come back. They all come back. Meanwhile, I am still in the studio today speaking with Mike Sicaro of Saturday Night Sock Hop. Mike, welcome back to our program.
Good to be back.
And now we were... You had left off asking, "What is the Did you say the qualitative definition?
What does it boil down to? What is the quintessence of faith? How would you describe it? I mean, if I believe, from what I understand, you would say it is at least trust in God.
Yes. If in the New Testament, if somebody had said, "What is saving faith?" they would have said, "You must seek God in prayer. Ask God to reveal himself to you to the point where you know for a fact that he exists." They would tell you that God had left a trail of breadcrumbs for you to follow. So there were some historical facts associated with the resurrection of Christ. It was actually a fact of history that can be verified. But still, that's not exactly the same as having an encounter with God. That would just be a way of opening a person's mind so that they'd have an incentive to pray. And then they'd say, after God reveals himself to you, you want to ask God to forgive you of your sins. Now, sin is kind of a buzzword, and so I always like to define terminology because not everybody that listens to our show is religious. Sin was defined in the Bible as selfishness, not positive self-esteem. I mean, you have a lot of accomplishments that you're proud of, and that's great, but the kind of selfishness where when the chips are down, we tend to put ourselves before others, like when the Nazis were saying, turn in your Jewish friend or we're going to kill you. Oh, well, okay, here's my friend. He's hiding over here. The kind of selfishness that says, look out for number one. The Bible says we're all guilty of that, and that is called sin. And what God has done through Jesus is he has paid the penalty for our sin. We deserve death and separation from God because of our sin. Jesus paid for our sin on the cross. The Bible doesn't explain metaphysically how he did that, but somehow the penalty for our sin was satisfied on the cross if we would but receive that. Now, we have to make a deal with God to turn from our sin, but even then, we recognize that we don't have the strength to do that on our own. And God says, I understand. That's why my spirit will come into your heart and start changing you. Because although, Mike, I can change my actions, I don't have a button on my side that I can push to change my thoughts and my motives. And I think any of us would not be too happy if everybody in the world could see our hearts and motives. We hide them from other human beings. God can see them. And God says, even though I can see them, I still love you. I will take care of that. I will transform that, but you have to let me. So an example that I like to use is if somebody had committed a crime, stood before the judge says, you've got to either go to jail for life or pay the court $500,000. That's it. And the guy says, well, I don't want to go to jail for life, Your Honor, but I don't have $500,000 either. What if the judge took compassion on that person, pulled out his checkbook and said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to write a check to the county clerk for $500,000. You just go pay and we let you off. Now, what would go on in our minds? That's too good to be true. People don't do that. He didn't deserve it. But what if that person said, thank you, Your Honor. The first thing I'm going to do now is go out and rob another bank. Then the judge would say, oh, whoa. Mm-hmm. Then I'm not going to pay you $500,000 to let you out. In a sense, Jesus paid the $500,000 for us on the cross. The penalty that we deserve for our selfishness, which the Bible calls sin, is death. He took that penalty on himself. But the deal is that we go to God and say, forgive me my past, but may your spirit come live inside of me to help me with my future. Now, as I interact with the Holy Spirit of God on a daily basis, that is the essence of my faith, which I'm defining as trust. And believe me, I would not have dedicated my life to something that might be true or that I just wanted to believe in or something that I thought was a fantasy. I know for a fact that Jesus exists because I've met Jesus. I said this to a Muslim one time. I said, the reason I know that Jesus is God and Jesus did claim to be an incarnation of God. I said, the reason I know Jesus is God is because I know Jesus. He says, oh, you mean you know about Jesus? I said, no, I know Jesus, period. He got very intrigued. He took out a notebook and literally interviewed me for an hour. He said, when did you meet him? How did you meet? I could see that he was just thirsting for something like that. We read all these incredible encounters in the Bible of God actually speaking to Abraham, speaking to Moses. This is no less than what God is offering us. It's not, I'll just start going to church. And, you know, churches teach dumb things at times. Churches do hypocritical things at times. Sometimes having an experience in a church can be the worst thing. I know that you're not claiming that you particularly had a bad experience in church.
No,
and I think that's great. But I know a lot of people that have, and I don't blame them for reacting against that. But there's such a difference between the hypocrisy of any organized religion and what Jesus actually taught. As a matter of fact, it was religious hypocrites that actually had Jesus crucified because Jesus was challenging them and saying, "Don't these teachers, these priests of yours, don't do what they say, but don't do what they do. Don't follow them. They're going to make you twice as fit for hell as they are." It's, they didn't like hearing that. So if anybody has a problem with religious hypocrisy, it's Jesus. But I've been talking far too much. I want to give you a chance to respond.
I would never argue with you, Bob.
No,
I mean, listen, my position.
I know you're not here to argue.
My position is here. I may be wrong. You may be right.
Sure.
Don't know.
You're just
my
here question for a discussion.
To you is, why would God have chosen you to have this transformative experience? Were you looking for it? Were you asking for it? Were you praying for it? I'm just wondering.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Was I looking for that exact experience? No. Was I looking for God in some way without realizing that I was looking for God? Yes. I believe that when a person, Mike, says that they're looking for truth, purpose, meaning, love, peace, that they're really looking for God without realizing it.
Ah.
And I was looking for those things. If you had told me, though, that I was going to become a Christian, I'm telling you, on a Monday morning, there was a movement that I became a Christian in 1973, which really substantially dates my age here because I was in college at the time. But there was a movement that broke out called Jews for Jesus.
Uh-huh.
I had grown up as a Jewish atheist, which really meant I didn't believe in the Old Testament or the New Testament, but I was attached to the culture of Judaism. That's why you can be a Jew and an atheist at the same time. And when this Jews for Jesus movement came out, I was absolutely infuriated. But I remember telling two girls I was going to college with that I would rather go to hell than become a Christian. I became a Christian one day later. So I did not think that I was looking for Jesus, but I could look back at that year and say, yeah, but I was looking for truth and purpose and meaning, and I was looking for those things.
It filled a void. It filled a need in your life. Was that safe to say?
It filled a void, and I believe that everybody has a void and fills it with something. If they don't fill it with God, they're going to fill it with something else.
Unquestionably true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so that was absolutely true. On the other hand, if somebody had come along and said to me, oh, you have this void and you're looking for something, well, we want to tell you about Jesus, I would have said to them, and I did say to them when I met some Christians, well, show me some facts. And if they had not been able to show me anything, and if I had not had an actual encounter with Jesus, I would have said, well, that's interesting, but it's going to take a blind faith to follow that, and I'm not going to waste my life following something which may not be true. So yes, it can fill a void, but I think the most important question we can ask is not, does it make it happy? Does it fill a void? The $50 million question here is this true? If it's true, we should be following it. If it's not true, we shouldn't be wasting our time with it. That's what I would say.
But it's true for you.
Well, if something's true, it's got to be true, period. I don't think there's such a thing as being true for one person and not something else.
Then we would both have the same strength of faith. We would both have the same level. I think we're both equally intelligent. I think this has nothing to do with education, IQ, or anything like that, or even upbringing. Maybe I'm wrong, but if that were the case, why would think that everyone would have the same degree
of
faith that you do?
No,
or about the same degree.
No, here's why I would disagree with that respectfully, because you are a very intelligent person, and I would not say that I'm more intelligent than you at all. And I wouldn't necessarily say that I was more educated than you either. I do think people get educated in different areas. For example, when I tell people, as I mentioned a few moments ago, that the resurrection of Christ is an historical fact, I'm guessing that most people have not heard the resurrection described that way. They say, well, I've heard that's a religious thing to believe in, but a fact? I tell people, I've done debates with atheists on campus. I've said the resurrection is as established of a fact as anything we accept in ancient history, even more established than some things we've accepted in more recent history. And the first reaction people have to that is, well, no, because, again, when religion comes up, people tend to assume that it's not true. And they do say, well, it could be true for you, but not for me. But what's interesting is I don't think we would say that in another discipline. For example, we now know that the world rotates around the sun. There was a time when people thought the other planets rotated around the Earth. Now, what if somebody today came and said, well, I'm still of the belief that the other planets rotate around the Earth, and I don't believe in a solar system where Earth and Mars and Jupiter rotate around the sun. And Mike, if you want to believe that, that's beautiful, and that's true for you, but it's not true for me. See, I think you'd say, well, no, look, the world either rotates around the sun or it doesn't. See, why are we so quick to say that truth is true for everybody in the sciences and other disciplines, but not as quick to say that that's got to be the standard for religion as well?
Because that truth can be quantified.
Okay, give me an example.
Truth in science, engineering, physics, mathematics, geography, everything you just mentioned, astronomy, can be quantified.
Okay.
It can be measured, it can be observed, and it could be, you have data that could be processed.
So here's my mind-blowing statement. We can just as much quantify all the claims of the Bible. Well, not all the enough claims of the Bible to know that the Bible is true.
Okay.
I know that's quite a statement, and that's, I wouldn't expect you or anybody to just take my word for it, but I would say that if we can't quantify it, I would not feel comfortable telling people to follow it. I have no need to get people to follow Christianity or follow anything about me. If this is not true for everybody, I've been wasting my time for the last 9 years coming on KCBQ talking about it.
No, Bobby, you haven't been wasting your time because your faith is, as I've said, unshakable. Your faith is unshakable. And I'll tell you something else. If I came to just about anyone who worked at this station, general manager, Heather, the sales manager, all of them, pretty much have an unshakable faith. If I walked into any of them and said, you know what, having a little problem here, I'm on the fence, help me out, they would probably drop whatever they were doing to help me. I know you would. I'm not even Jewish. I could go into a synagogue and any rabbi would say, sit down, booby, let me help you. I ought to be glad to talk to you.
But the phrase unshakable faith, I would say, is a neutral term. I would say, well, faith in what? And why is that faith unshakable? And are they putting their faith in something that is true? It's kind of like when, I remember a couple of years ago, I was visiting Julian, and I was anxious to get back to one of my favorite restaurants because they made the best beef ribs I'd ever had. Somebody said, oh, the restaurant's under new management, and it's great because he's changed everything. And I said, well, change is kind of a neutral word. That sounds great that there's change, but he could have changed it for the good. He could have changed it for the bad. Turned out he changed it for the bad because they didn't have those big beefy ribs anymore. Okay.
These things happen, Bob.
Change, unshakable faith. Those are very neutral terms. I want to know what they have their faith in. People had an unshakable faith in Hitler when he came. They used to say, the Nazis used to say, follow Hitler with your heart, not your mind. And they do that with politicians today. I won't name any today. We'll take the day off from that. But we'll be right back. I am here with our good friend Mike Zuccaro. Great honor to have him discussing faith. We'll be right back.
Kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, how do you know the Bible's true? Do you say something like, I just know it is? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that he is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that.
educateforlife.org. If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
We are here with Mike Sakura of Saturday Night Sock Hop, and we were talking about faith. And I had a question I wanted to ask you, Mike, and I know, again, we're here, if you've just tuned in, we're here to have a discussion. Mike did not come to be argumentative or to prove any point, but he's raising some really good questions. I think it's a great discussion. I've been enjoying it. And when we talked about the difference between faith and other disciplines, you said because these other disciplines, like the sciences, histories, can be quantified, what would it take for a belief in God to be quantified to you so that it's no longer a belief? What would it take for you to know for a fact that there's a God rather than having to follow it through some kind of blind faith?
I suppose some kind of transformative experience, as you have had.
Okay.
That would be one thing. I mean, I wonder why, in a world where there is, as you would say, an omnipotent God, an omnipresent God, why is there so much suffering? Why are there so much pain? Why do terrible things happen to good people? I mean, could it possibly be that we're all just here to, you know, fight each other and kill each other on a, you know, on a yearly basis? We're here to help each other. I mean, if nothing else, I think that's the big question. That would really help me a lot. I mean,
right. Well, let me put a flag on something, but it'll be an important thing to return to. I would start by saying the very fact that we recognize that there is such a thing as good and evil, I would say there could be no such thing as good and evil if God didn't exist, because concepts such as good and evil would be things that we as human beings are just making up. And if human beings are here by randomness and chance, we can change our opinions of good and evil. But like I said, I want to put a flag on that instead of getting on a tangent. Why would God allow suffering? Because he gave human beings free will. If God wanted to have created robots or marionettes on a string or computer programs, he could have. If I had a choice between making somebody fall in love with me by sticking a love potion in their drink or having them get to know me and make a choice, I'd rather they make a choice. I think that's what most sane people would choose. God does not want to force us to serve him. Good and evil are not substances. They're not things that we see in a test tube. Good and evil are choices and actions that human beings make. So God did not create good or evil. What he created was human personality. And embedded in a human personality is free will. Unfortunately, the ability to do right includes the ability to do wrong, or it's not a real ability. And so, I think that's the I realize that you're asking a very important question, and I don't mean to oversimplify it, but I think that's the beginning of the answer, at least.
That's a huge and ultimately unanswerable philosophical question. But I guess here's the point, Bob. It ought not be necessary for me to require any proof, because I went through that whole 12 years of Catholic school and no one that I'm aware of questioned it the way I did. Now, maybe they didn't. They didn't tell me. Nobody else required it. I mean, not to the degree that I did. Everyone else went along. And no matter what faith you may be, Bob, at a young age, you are pretty much inculcated. You know, you are kind of taken into this faith. And most people, to one degree or another, follow it without requiring any further proof.
And I think that was a disadvantage and not an advantage. I do not, because I'm telling you, Mike, these students that you were there with who weren't questioning it then, I guarantee you when they got into college, and they had professors ripping into the Bible, they did start questioning it, and it would have done them some good to have the priests or the Mother Superior come along and say, look, one of these days somebody's going to come along and say, show me proof or evidence that God exists, and here's some things you can show them. It would have been a better education if they had done that. I think you might have been there 10 years, and this wasn't your fault, but I believe you got shortchanged.
Well, this is, let's say, 19 from the mid-60s till about the mid-70s. You know, it was still pretty hardcore, but this transcends any educational experience, because there are people of every religion who have questions about faith.
Absolutely.
I could be Jewish, I could be a Muslim, I could be a Shinto, it doesn't make any difference. Every faith, there are people who question it.
And they should question it, and they're good questions. And the only problem is that usually when they give the questions, they're not given answers. Usually what they're told is, well, you just got to accept it by faith.
Yes, yeah, and exactly.
They, you know, one of my favorite radio talk show hosts, except for the Bob Siegel Show, of course, is Dennis Prager, who does a wonderful job defending the existence of God. But then when it gets a little bit more specific, like things out of the Bible, then he'll start saying things like, oh, I don't believe in intellectualizing the Bible or Bible apologetics. He says, because it takes away from the beauty of faith. And again, I just want to pull my hair out. I say, Dennis, following something blindly is not a beautiful thing. If there is a God, I would expect that a loving God would make himself known. I would expect that he would have given us a trail of breadcrumbs. And I think he did in the human personality, in the conscience. How do we get the personal from the impersonal? Stars and dust and chemicals can't think. How can there be a time when there wasn't sentience and self-awareness? Something had to always exist. That something that had to always exist had to be a thinking, feeling, sentient personality. Otherwise, we can't possibly explain where personality came from. I think right in our DNA, if we're really made in God's image, there's a reflection of that. So I believe he's done a lot to actually make himself known. And I think it would be reasonable for him, especially when you add, and Christians aren't the only ones to do it. So many religions add things about the afterlife, and you're going to be in all this trouble if you don't believe in God. And so somebody's standing before God someday and says, okay, well, I know you exist now because I'm standing here. I'm in heaven. I see you. He goes, well, yeah, but you didn't believe in me back then. Yeah, but God, that's just because I was a free thinker. I wasn't gullible like my friends. I wasn't easily brainwashed. I had questions. Sorry. He goes, well, I believe now. I'm here. Sorry. You had to do it then, or it doesn't count. You lost salvation, but we have lovely rotisserie for you. See, that would not be a loving God. That would be a cruel and vindictive God.
That is true.
I just don't think it makes sense that God would say, follow me by blind faith. And to those of you that were so gullible that you followed me without question, I'm going to reward you, booby. And for those of you that were free-thinking people, the heck, I don't think so. I think God loves the free thinkers just as much.
Then it's entirely possible that the answer to your question is, I am apparently not yet receptive to this. If I'm ever going to be, like I said, could change at any time. But I mean, I'm not a kid anymore.
I'm actually of the opinion that you're already very receptive, and I don't expect you to automatically agree with me, but in my experience of talking with people, you are far more open and honest than many I've talked to. And I don't believe this conversation would even be of interest to you, or that you would take the time to even sit down with me over a cup of coffee to discuss it, let alone talk about it on the radio where others are listening, if there isn't something inside of you that may just be longing for something like this.
Don't get the wrong. First,
well, I could be wrong, but that's my experience with people. That would be my insight at this point.
I don't know if you're right about that. My Sunday afternoons are sacred. I spend them with good friends, and I look forward to all week. And I'm sacrificing that to be here tonight. I for a long time I've been saying, one of these days I'm going to sit down with Bob Siegel.
Okay.
And we're just going to discuss.
I'm very glad you did.
That's all it is. It's just I should have a T-shirt made that says, I may be wrong. You may be right. It could all change tomorrow. You know, that's it. That's all. That's my position. You know.
Yeah. I am seeing some openness in you, and you've expressed openness. You've said I'm not here to argue. I could be convinced, and you keep going back to that experience that you have not yet had with God. I do think you could go to God in prayer, and I wouldn't expect you to have the exact same experience I had. There's only one God. That doesn't mean we all have to have the exact identical experience. But I believe that if you went to God and said, God, do what it takes to make yourself known to me. You know me, and you know what it would take. But the deal is, if you do that, God, I am going to serve you. I'm going to serve you the rest of my life.
Gotcha.
It's as if I said to you, God may or may not be on the other side of that door. But if you open the door and he's there, will you serve him? Now, some people have been honest enough to say to me, no, I wouldn't. So I'm going to leave the door closed because I don't want to go the rest of my life knowing God's there and I'm not serving him. Mm-hmm. It would be easier to just not even open the door and say ignorance is bliss and not even try it out. But that's the way I would put it. The Bible says God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And like I said, I think we can be seeking God without knowing that we're seeking God. We're calling it, a search for truth, peace, purpose. I think people want to know why they're here. They want to know what their purpose is. You seem to be a person of high conscience. That's why the suffering in the world bothers you. I don't hear you saying, well, as long as it doesn't affect me in my life, who cares? I think you're somebody who would be bothered if you heard about suffering in the third world, even if you knew it was never going to affect you.
That will never end. That will never end. As long as there's been civilization, there's always been haves and have-nots and people who have gotten a bad lot in life and things that we cannot do to help everyone. I understand. You're talking about having a social conscience here.
Well, and we're talking about the fact that human beings have always had free will and always will. And again, the ability to do right includes the ability to do wrong. Mm-hmm. We have choices that we make.
All right. That's an enormous philosophical question. I didn't want to put you on the spot.
Right, right.
But here's the thing, Bob.
Sure.
As of today, I don't feel a void in my life. Now, not saying that there isn't one that I'm not aware of, but I don't feel any gnawing need. I mean, my needs are remarkably simple. I need to be good at what I do, first and foremost. I need to be good at what I do, and I am good at what I do. That pays the bills. That keeps me happy. I really don't have a void, right? Say, wow, if I could just, fill this, I'd be a happy guy.
It depends on how we define void. It sounds like if we're defining void as the absence of happiness, it sounds like, no, you don't have a void. It sounds like you're a very content person and you're already very happy, and that's great. And I'm not here to say if you followed God or followed Jesus, you'd necessarily be happier. I am here to say that it goes beyond what makes us happy. There is such a thing, again, as what is true and what is the right thing to do. If we are all sinful, if we all have a side of our nature that's selfish, and I don't think you would say that you don't, then that is a kind of void also. I'd call it a moral void, and I'd key in more on those lines than just the question of how happy we are.
Okay, because now we're back to necessary and sufficient conditions. Is it necessary to be happy, or is it sufficient to be happy? Should there be happiness and spiritual connection? Now it gets a bit more nebulous, does it not?
You can always find some Christian that says, well, you think you're happy, but there's depths of happiness you'll have with Jesus. I'm not going to do that to you, because I've met religious people that are miserable, and I've met atheists that are very happy.
I believe.
And I don't think it's a matter of just being happy. I think it's a matter of really dealing with our sin. If somebody doesn't believe that they have a serious problem with sin and selfishness, it's not going to make a whole lot of sense to them to seek out God and Jesus. That's where I would go with that. And it wouldn't just be a matter of happiness.
But the philosopher would say, can an ethical life be lived without religion? Now I ask you.
And I would say the answer to that would be, I define religion and I define having a relationship with God differently.
Maybe I should say, can an ethical life be lived without faith? That's what we're talking about.
Or
all
not
right?
even faith. Can an ethical life be lived without having a genuine relationship with God?
Okay.
I would say it can be partially. Before I became a Christian, I've done good things. You seem like a really nice guy. But see, if we're half clean and half dirty, we still need to take a shower. We don't just go around showing people the clean side. And we can put on a pretty good show on the outside. If you take the humanitarian of the 20th century, who's usually viewed as the greatest humanitarian who ever lived, that would be Mahatma Gandhi. Who's ever lived a better life than Gandhi? You know, it's interesting. You read Gandhi's diaries. He didn't think he led a good life at all. He said, I am a sinner. He wasn't even a Christian. But he studied Christianity, and when he got to Paul's discussions in Romans about sin, he said, that's me. He says, boy, if you could see inside my heart, you would see this sin. And his sin bothered him so much. He was doing so much to purge himself of his sin. He tried harder than anybody else around him to live a better life. So by comparison to everybody else, people were going, well, who cares about righteousness more than Gandhi? So he came across as a guy who was living a pretty good life. He would have said, no, was not living a good life. What you saw me doing was hungering and thirsting for righteousness. Well, now we get back to the void, and depending on what kind of void it is, I'm defining it as a moral void. Jesus said in his Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied." He didn't say, "Blessed are they who just look for a more content life."
And he didn't say knowledge.
No, because knowledge by itself, knowledge by itself is not sufficient. Knowledge is a good thing. It's one of many traits in life, and there's a big difference between knowledge and wisdom.
Again, a necessary but not a sufficient condition.
That's right. Okay. Right. And so what God wants to relate to us through knowledge and through morality as well. If knowledge is keeping people hung up, if they say, "Well, I just don't know if there's a God," then God will move mountains to make himself known. But the ultimate barrier between God and man is a moral barrier. God can take care of the knowledge part of it really easily. If somebody is really seeking to purge themselves of their sins, they're eventually going to find Jesus. Give me an example. I used to do campus ministry out at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and we used to set up a table a lot. And I had a guy walk up to me one time. He says, "You know, I like to get high on a joint once in a while, but I would never set up a table telling other people that they should get high on joints too." In other words, where did I get the nerve to say that what worked for me, Jesus, must work for him as well, or else? And I said to him, "Well, you know what? If Jesus was just some joint to get high on, I would agree with you. But let me ask you a question." I said, "If you knew the cure for cancer, would you share it with people?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Would you put up a table, say we have the cure for cancer?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "If they ever cure cancer, will you agree that that's the cure?" Which sounded like a pretty ridiculous question. But he said, "Well, of course." I said, "Well, isn't that awfully closed-minded of you? I mean, maybe vitamin C is the cure for cancer. Maybe penicillin is the cure for cancer." He said, "Well, no, if they come up with the cure, that's it." I said, "Well, Jesus is the cure for something deadlier than cancer, sin." The word gospel means good news. That includes many things, but predominantly the good news that we can be forgiven of our sin, turn from our sin, escape other people's sin. Well, good news doesn't mean anything without the bad news. The bad news is that we have sinned. If people don't understand that they've sinned, beyond saying, "Well, nobody's perfect, we all do little things." When I reached a point where I realized that I wasn't quite the good person that I thought I was, the gospel of Jesus Christ made sense to me. Prior to that, it never would have made sense. I used to hear the word sin, and I go, what are they talking about? And then, of course, you have legalistic Christians that make up all this stuff that isn't even in the Bible. It's a sin to dance, it's a sin to drink, stuff that the Bible doesn't even say.
You know? So do you feel that this happened to you when you were in college. Do you feel that you were living a life that was somehow profoundly immoral?
No.
Or no? Okay.
That's what's interesting. It wasn't profoundly immoral. I was a pretty nice person. I'd always considered myself a pretty nice guy, but I just realized that I didn't really care that much about anybody but myself. And that alone really bothered me. And it was mostly an inward struggle. Even after I became a Christian, I graduated San Jose State as a drama major. I was in a lot of plays, wrote a lot of plays, read a lot of novels. And I loved reading the works of Arthur Miller and the Greek tragedies and Shakespeare, because they were always looking at the human condition. And I know you're a lover of the arts too, and the most profound arts talk about that human condition and the imperfection of people, and just saying, why are we the way we are? So it was my human nature. And honestly, Mike, I didn't come to the conclusion that I was any worse than anybody else. I said, you know, we're all in this boat. We all think we're good, and we're not that good. And ever since we've had man, we've had war, crime, bloodshed. And even though I haven't gone out and done those things, in my heart, those kinds of things happen. That was the bad news. And that made me more receptive to the good news that I could be forgiven of that. But I want to make, again, I couldn't make this too clear. If somebody came along and said, "Bob, the good news is that Jesus forgave you of your sin," I still would not have accepted that without saying, "Prove to me that that's true." I would have said, "That sounds nice. That sounds great." Just like the guy that's in court and the judge says, "I got $500,000 check for you." I said, "That sounds great, but I don't believe it for a second. I don't think that's really going to happen." I had to see proof and evidence for it. And that included a relationship with God himself, but it also includes all kinds of things that God has shown us throughout history, and verifications of the Bible, from fulfilled prophecies to histories that were contemporaries of the Bible that corroborated the same things. Other historians writing about Jesus, even people that weren't Christians, authenticating that the man lived, that the man did miracles, that the man rose from the dead. I mean, there's actually a much more overwhelming testimony than people think. And I'm guessing you heard none of that in Catholic school.
Oh, Bob, we went through, I mean, we didn't read each chapter of the Bible, you know, paragraph by paragraph. We didn't have hardcore Bible study, but I've had religion classes every year. Every semester. I mean, even in high school. I mean, you know, it was part of the curriculum.
Sure, but usually a religion class is, this is what the Bible says, and I believe it, and you have to have faith.
It wasn't,
here's some evidence that the Bible is true. Yeah. That's very different.
No, it's almost like a rote memorization type thing.
Yes.
It's like what I went through when I was confirmed, you know, okay, read this, memorize this, give it back to the teacher, boom, you're in the club. That's exactly. A different... We were talking about, now, you were not bar mitzvah, right?
I was not bar mitzvah. I was a spoiled kid. I didn't want to be bar mitzvah. I didn't want to go to Hebrew school.
I would have been you. Had I been born Jewish, I would have been you. What did your parents think?
Well...
Shanda. I went to the wrong boy.
Yeah.
Took on the wrong kid.
It's kind of funny because my parents, like I mentioned earlier on the program, that Judaism is both a culture and a religion. My parents were into the culture, not the religion. When we were little kids, my mom would read some of the Old Testament Bible stories, and my dad would get kind of impatient. He'd say, those are fairy tales. Why are we even bothering reading those? And so I didn't, you know, I always heard, well, Jews are people that believe in the Old Testament but not the New. I didn't believe in either Testament, and yet some of the Jewish holidays like Yom Kippur and stuff we would celebrate, heard all about the Holocaust, heard all about Israel, heard all about Zionism. And when I became a Christian, my dad was so upset, he literally disowned me and kicked me out of the house.
Wow. I was going to ask if your parents, how they handled that. Did you guys ever reconcile?
We did not. My dad passed away in the year 2001, and we never reconciled. And I was a pretty spoiled kid up to that point. All of a sudden, I was on my own. I was working my way through college, cooking my own meals, paying my own bills, doing my own laundry. Forced me to grow up. But in my dad's mind, I was a traitor because he thought about the way Jews have been persecuted in the name of Christianity and called Christ killers. Some of it was understandable, but he was also the kind of person you just couldn't talk to.
Wow.
I couldn't sit down and say, hey, Dad, it was nothing personal. And so, now here's another interesting thing, Mike. They told me, all you got to do is stop being a Christian. You can come home. Just deny it. Deny Christ. Come home. You can live here again. We'll forgive you. We'll put you through college. Wow. You'll have a roof over your head again. The reason I didn't do that is I knew for a fact. I would not have gone through that for faith.
Oh, no, you had a,
I went through that.
You had a powerful experience, and your mom was on the same page.
That experience was a fact. My mom would not have, well, she was just as upset as my dad. She would not have kicked me out of the house, but my dad was not somebody that anyone stood up to, so she went along with it. After he passed away, I did have a reconciliation with my mother. She unfortunately passed away this year, too, but we ended up having a great relationship in her latter years, so I am at least grateful for that.
Yeah, you should, because a lot of wasted years there.
Yeah, yeah, and it's unfortunate. When my children were younger, I sat down and told them that story, and I did say to them, "I want you to know that even though I've raised you as a Christian, if the day ever came where you stopped being a Christian, I would be bothered, but I will always be your dad. I would never disown you." It was very important that they had me sit down and tell them that, so that they didn't worry that some kind of generational thing could happen and I would do the same thing to them.
All right. I just wanted to know.
That's
Didn't want to pry. Just wanted to ask.
Well, we didn't mean to make it into a tearjerker there. Well, we got just a few minutes left. I wanted to see if there's there's the music. Did you have another question you wanted to shoot?
No, Bob. Are we going to take a break right now, or is the show winding up?
The show's actually winding up.
Well, thank you very much for having
Mike,
me, Bob.
This was
a lot of fun.
It was just a pleasure, and I do hope you'll come back again if you have other questions or points you want to make or whatever.
You'll get the first call.
I think these conversations are great to have, and it's always good to have people sit down and discuss something, and even if they don't entirely agree, without anybody getting bent out of shape, it's wonderful. You're a great guy. I love listening to your program. And everybody, Saturday Night Sock Up, still at 9 o'clock?
Oh, no, 8 to 11. They got an extra
11. Well, wonderful. Saturday Night Sock Up, 8 to 11. when the blasted football game isn't on.
It's over. That's it's it. Over. Okay. That's it. I made a phone call. It's over. I called Vito Corleone. Oh, I'm going to take care of the ball games. It's over, my friend.
My son Santino's doing a radio show.
All right.
Mike, thank you. God bless.
Good night.
And everybody, again, we got a few repeat broadcasts coming up, and I hope you have a wonderful Christmas holiday, and I will see you in January.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.